they called Michael Dunn, who shot my son, called the music thug music, which is the new N-word. People call it the N-word. They don't say nigger anymore. They say N-word. It's more polite. But now it's thug music. Okay. So now the kids, when they play their music, whether it's hip-hop or rap, it's considered something that they've seen on television. They've seen the guys with the gold teeth and the stacks of money and the naked women walking around the pool and the guns sitting on their laps. And the people that don't have the opportunity to immerse themselves with the African Americans of this country, with the Latinas and the Latino Americans in this country, all they have to go by is what they see on that television, what they see in the movies. So immediately when you see them, this is what goes through your head, thugs. Michael Dunn, within 2 seconds, labeled Jordan Davis, a middle-class suburbanite kid, a thug. And everything from that point on, 3.5 minutes, like our film suggests, in 3.5 minutes, he went from engaging these kids verbally and pulling a gun, not only shooting and killing Jordan Davis, but trying to kill every last one of those kids in the car.
How many times did he fire?
He fired 10 times into a car that was trying to get out of his way. And in the second trial, they said, "Why did you stop firing? You had 5 more bullets." He said, "Because they got out of range. Had they been in range, I would have fired 50 more times." And it's not just Michael Dunn, it's society. That your black youth like this gentleman is not worth it. In our trial, we couldn't call Jordan Davis a victim. They denied us to call my son, shot in the chest 3 times, choking on his blood. He's not considered a victim in our trial. They told me and his mother that we can't show too much emotion or cry in the courtroom or we have to remove you. As a matter of fact, normally we let the parents sit in the first row. We need you to sit in the second row because we don't want the jurors to see the look on your face when we mention your son. So we must swallow that, as you said, that we don't even have the rights as we navigate the justice system. Also, I want you to actually give a round of applause to Jordan Davis's mother, who is here, Lucia McBath. Could you please stand up? I could not do the work that I do without a partner helping me do this work. And through our efforts, hopefully, great people like you that we have in this room, people that are educated, people that are connected, that can connect with people that maybe an African American like me or Clifton could not reach, can help tell our story of what we go through every day as being looked at as thugs.
You know, you raise this question about being looked at as thugs, and it causes us, it really compels us to do some introspection. Some deep introspection, because I'm sure that none of you would raise your hand and say, "I'm a racist. I'm biased." Maybe you would, probably not. And yet, if you're honest with yourself, and please be honest with yourself, you're out. A young black man walks on an elevator. Do you pull your purse a little bit tighter? When you're driving through a neighborhood and you see a young black man in a corner, do you silently reach over and lock your car door? When you're going through a community and you see a young black man in a store, do you maybe go in a different direction? Those are the small things that add up to implicit bias, and they're felt deeply, and they can lead to misunderstandings, and they can lead to deadly outcomes. So we only have a short bit of time, but before we move on to the next conversation, if you want to build some kind of trust, in your case with the police department, in your case in trying to ask Americans to think about how they view young black men, what's one thing you would ask of the police department or larger society or a view of larger society? Ron, you first.
The first thing that I really want to say before I even think about leaving here is that when you look at what we consider ghettos or black neighborhood and they say black-on-black crime, it's not black-on-black crime, it's neighbor-on-neighbor crime. That's the name of it. In other words, a black person doesn't come out his house in the ghetto and say, I'm going to victimize that person because they're black, like me. What they do is they victimize people that live near them. Because if they truly want to victimize somebody, why would you victimize somebody that has maybe $20 in their pocket? You would go to an athlete's house that's black that you know plays for Florida State or somebody else and victimize them if it's a black-on-black crime because you know they may have $500 or $600 in their wallet. So it's neighbor-to-neighbor crime. Don't want to go out of their neighborhood to victimize somebody. What I say is education is the key. If I ask everybody in this room to raise their hand, if you've stepped in college, at least one day in college, could you please raise your hand? If you had at least one day in college. Now, again, have anybody in this room been in a private prison, gone to private prison? Raise their hand. You see, there's only a few people. Because the key to not going to these private prisons where they further victimize you is through education. That's what you have to understand. This country, 2.2 million people, which is ridiculous that they incarcerate. And most of them are African Americans and the Latinos. Understand, when they get out of prison, where do they go? They go to your neighborhoods to rob you. They get on the elevator with you when you hold your purse to rob you. But they're being victimized every day. They have the CCA, which is the Correction Corporation of America. They're on the stock exchange, one of the best trading stocks there is, victimizing these people in prison because the 13th Amendment said they abolish slavery unless it's a form of punishment. So they have slavery in every institution, and these private prisons are getting millions and millions and billions of dollars. Columbia University just got publicly outed that they invested in CCA, a prison, and so now they stopped investing in prison. I'm sure there's a lot of corporations that invest in prisons. What you're doing is creating monsters in these private prisons. And for you to change and make a change, you have to build more schools, give more education, and stop building more prisons.
You have the last word, and what is the one thing that you think should be done in your community to help build trust, which is so badly needed?
Not only in Ferguson, but in Baltimore, in Staten Island, in America, and really across the world, I want to boggle your minds a little bit. Understand that America has always existed under some form of a racial caste system. Whether that been slavery, the Black Codes, Jim Crow, or what we are now dealing with, which is mass incarceration, which entails into policing. What would I like to see in my community is an end to state violence, but I know it's not easy to end. Advice I would give to many of the elites, and particularly the white community, is that understand that you don't know what we go through. No matter how many degrees you have, no matter the PhDs, no matter what research you go through, understand that these young people have been on this front line and they've actually experienced this state violence. They've actually experienced, I have a rubber bullet mark still on my arm, a scar. And also know that you have a certain privilege. It's called white privilege. Understand that you have this white privilege, but don't feel guilty. Use your privilege to help bring a sort of change. Go back into your communities. Go back into your communities, have real conversations about race, and understand that we don't live in this post-racial world. Growing up, I was taught that, you know, Martin Luther King marched, they passed bills, and then everything was okay. You know, we elected President Obama, and then everything was okay. That's not real. If we really want to get real about doing something, we got to get real with each other. You understand what I'm saying? Honestly. And two, being that this is a youth-led movement and primarily being led by some young black women, understand that you don't have to marginalize young voices. I met with some incredible young students across St. Louis, across the United States and from South Africa yesterday. Amplify young voices. Instead, center your work around young people. Don't tell them to follow you, follow them. And I really mean that. And to many of the young black people who have been traumatized by this state violence, by this police violence, it's gonna be a long fight. And I want everyone to understand that if an oppressed peoples are an oppressed, you can't tell an oppressed peoples how to behave under oppressive systems. So when there are uprisings, don't call them looters and rioters. You know, understand why it's happening. I think people look at the content rather than the context that created the situation in the first place, right?
So it's like we are afraid of the outcome, and maybe we should be afraid of the underlying causes that that led to that.
Exactly.
I'm going to say, watch this space. Clifton Kinney, I think I speak for everyone in the room. We can't wait to see what you bring us as you march forward into life and into college. Thank you so much for sharing your story, Ron Davis. Thank you very much. Lucy McFadden, thank you very much for being with us. Thank you. We're going to continue this conversation. I'm going to ask, as Ron and Clifton leave the stage, if Connie Rice, Dr. Rice, will you join me on stage? I'm not checking my email, really. I'm not. I just have some notes on here, and I want to make sure I get this right. Okay, can you just kind of scoot up and get comfortable? Is that okay? You gonna be okay?
No.
Okay. Well, see now, but doesn't she look elegant once she sat down?
It's all an illusion.
Connie Rice is the director of the Advancement Project. That's a public policy and legal action group. She works hard to erase barriers to opportunity. She was formerly with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in California. She worked with Morrison Foerster in private practice, and she was named one of the most influential lawyers, I was going to say in Los Angeles, and when I did my research, I was corrected to say in the entire state of California and the western United States. So there. She has done extensive work with the LAPD, the Los Angeles Police Department, in helping to understand the conditions of policing, the relationship between police officers and the community. And she's learned quite a bit, and I'd like for you to share some of that with us today. First of all, how was it that you were called in to work with the police department? Was it after the uprising following the Rodney King verdict?
Well, I sued the police for a very long time.
More than once, right?
Oh, I get up every morning and think of a new way to sue LAPD. In the shower. I mean, it was war, Michelle. I mean, LAPD didn't talk. LAPD was a warrior force. And they saw their job as completely suppressing and containing the poor African-American community, and by extension, all African-Americans. They didn't care if you were a senator, a judge, or Pookie from the Grape Street Crips. They were going to pull you out of your car and prone you out. I'll never forget the day they pulled me over and I said, if you make me lie down on the ground, we are going to have a real problem. So they didn't prone me out, but they started to.
Prone you up just to make you understand.
They make you lie on the ground
down
with
like,
your
like
arms
you're making
and legs
reverse
spread,
snow angels.
Right. It's very humiliating. Especially if you're in a suit. It was war.
So they called you
it
in to work
war.
With them.
It was war. No, I was at war with them. And the only way to talk to LAPD was to sue them, because they did not talk. They didn't talk to anybody. They were a Praetorian Guard. Remember the Praetorian Guard? You ever learned about that in Roman history? kill anybody on sight and just purposefully arrogant and compulsively mean. Okay? And they looked at the black community, particularly with chiefs like Daryl Gates. Well, Daryl Gates was actually one of the racial progressives in LAPD. That tells you where they were, right? And I remember the first time I deposed Daryl Gates, and I realized, oh my gosh, this guy is seen as a progressive within the culture. So, no, they did not pull me in at that point. They did not pull me in right after the Rodney King beating.
When did
and the riots. Michelle, I ended up deciding that we could do war for a very long time, and I love fighting. There's something wrong with me. I probably need therapy because I love to fight. And I love litigating, and litigation is nothing but war with paper. And I'm very good at it. I don't lose. If I sue you, it is not a good day, okay? I won all my cases against LAPD. Yeah, you need to be afraid. I won every single case, every single class action. I did them with the ACLU. I did them with the NAACP. I had coalitions of people, Humanists and Carol Sobel. We have an army of folks who are expert in suing police in LA because that was the only way we could talk to them was by suing them, and it was war. So fast forward, I had I walk into my office at the Legal Defense Fund and I look through the glass and I think, oh my God, Dad has come to visit me. I thought it was my father. And as I got closer, I realized, no, that's not Dad. He looks like his fraternal twin, but that's not Dad. It was Assistant Chief Jess Brewer of the LAPD. And I said, Chief? He said, yes, Connie, I'm so pleased that you were here in LA. I'd been in LA maybe 6 months at that point. He said, I'm so pleased that you're here. I said, what can I do for you? He says, I am here to teach you how to bring LAPD down. And I just looked at him, he said, I've had it. I've spent my entire career there. I am the highest ranking black officer, and I cannot tell you what I had to sacrifice to get there. I have sacrificed my dignity. They forced me to let go of my identity as an African American man. And after the Rodney King beating, I'm done. I'm going to tell you what you have to do. Connie, you cannot bring LAPD down to its knees and force it to listen by representing the Rodney Kings of the world, the victims of police abuse. What you have to do is represent cops. You need to divide and conquer.
So what I want to talk to you about is the work you did when you actually sat down with the police officers, because you had a unique opportunity. You were able to sit down with them.
I started learning their lives, Michelle. I mean, once you start to represent a cop, I started with the African-American officers who were trying to do the right thing. And then I realized, okay, there are a lot of good cops. The problem is that the bad cops are in charge of the culture. The bad cops ran LAPD. And I said, okay, there are these good cops. And I knew there were good cops because I would get calls even 10 years before. I'm sorry, even 3 years before, but all through my career of suing LAPD, whether representing cops or victims of police abuse, I would get calls from cops, and they were in telephone booths. For you young people, It's a little box.
It's a little box that's out
in public, and it's got a telephone in it, and you put money in it, and you can call for help, right? I know you don't know what I'm talking about. But they'd be in the telephone booths, and they were calling my office, and they would say, Miss Rice, whispering, don't go down to Watts. Graveyard is gunning for you. Meaning, the graveyard shift was going to kill me if they found me in Watts that night. They would tell me, don't go to Watts. So the good cops were trying to protect me. They were trying to warn me. And they were so scared of the bad cops that they were whispering in a telephone booth as if anybody could hear them. But that's how scared they were of the cops. And my one client, who's an officer, he was a captain. He said, Connie, if they plant evidence on a drug dealer, they can plant evidence on me, and these cops will kill me.
So when you actually started interviewing police officers, when you started talking to them, you learned about their lives. And one of the things that you were able to glean is how they viewed the people that they actually policed. And I would like for you to share that with us, because that was really deep. They talked to you at some point about their fears.
Terrified. These people that they policed were not human.
In their eyes.
In the police eyes, they were in a war, and everybody in that community was part of that war. And they were fair game. They were fair game to be shot. They were fair game to be raised to the ground, proned out, thrown in jail. And for the bad cops, who could plant evidence on people. And you could put innocent people in prison, and they did it with impunity, and they knew they'd be backed up by the larger culture. It was really quite stunning. And the black cops felt bad. Most of the black cops who ended up being my clients, they'd be in my office in tears because of the guilt and the shame of having turned against their own people in order to be blue. In order to be blue, if you're a black cop, you've got to prove that you've got more loyalty for the force than you do to your community.
So when you hear a rap music lyric where they talk about police officers who are black, who are sometimes even harder on the community, that's
a fact.
The root of that. One of the things that you told, you did a wonderful interview with my colleague David Green, which some of you may have heard on Morning Edition, aired within the last year, and it was riveting. It was one of those what we call driveway moments, because you couldn't turn away from it. But you said that once you earned their trust, the police officer's trust, and they started talking to you, and they talked to you about their fears, one of the things they talked about is the fear of the perpetrator. The fear, I asked Clifton what went through his mind when he saw a police officer. You learned a little bit about what went through the mind of a police officer when they saw particularly a young man of color in a certain part of town.
Oh, yeah.
And it was surprising for listeners to hear how much they were motivated by their own fears. Talk a little bit about
that. Yes, Chief Bratton, to keep me busy and to keep me from suing him, he was very smart. He asked me to interview about 800 of his officers, and I did, and it took me about 18 months. And I had a series of questions that I asked, and I wanted to know what they really thought. I said, this is a way to really map the mindset of a cop. And I could find out from almost 1,000 of them what they really think, right? It's a nice way to survey. So I just, day to day, I would just go from division to division interviewing all these cops. And what I learned was that they're terrified. They're terrified that they're not going to make it home that night. They're terrified that someone's going to ambush them, that someone's going to kill them. And the profiling, as I said to John Mack, I said, it's not about profiling black people. It's about the profiling takes place at the neighborhood level. So when you go down to South LA, you interview any cop, I don't care whether they're Asian, Mexican-American, black, white, I don't care what color they are or what community they come from. When you mention South LA to an LA cop, he's going to tell you the following, because I didn't get a single answer that was ever different to this question. I asked them, what does it mean to police in South LA? Oh, well, Ms. Rice, that we call that stick time, because we get to use our batons with impunity and no one will complain because the crime's so high. Oh, that's a high crime area. That means we get to do a righteous shoot. And if we get a righteous shoot, SWAT will see us and think we're aggressive and we get into a specialized unit. Oh, Ms. Rice, I would sit there and try not to have my mouth hang open because I didn't want to seem shocked. I wanted them to continue to trust me. And I don't betray their identities when they tell me these things because they need to trust me. If they're going to pay me the honor of being honest and they're going to give me their real thinking, I need to honor them by not revealing who they are, and I said I would keep them anonymous. I said, I will use a quote from you if you can pick it out and tell me which one's your quote. But all of them said the same thing. They couldn't pick one from the other, so I got to use all the quotes anonymously. But it was just stunning the way that the minds, and this was cops across the board, when they think of a poor black neighborhood, they are thinking it is a shooting gallery. I will end up dead if I don't do hair trigger shooting, And if I don't look at this as a place to be extremely aggressive, they don't know anybody's name. I said, how many kids' names do you know? They didn't know anybody. Have you ever lived here? Not a single one. Not even the black cops had lived in Watts. They knew no one. They knew no one. They were not allowed to get to know anybody because they were at war. It was warrior policing. They described their own policing as warrior policing. And it gave me all of the ideas that I needed to unwind this ball of yarn. Because they were honest, they gave me the blueprint to reverse every bit of this kind of thinking.
So the LA Police Department is very different now than it was under Daryl Gates. It's very different now than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. They've learned a lot from this experience, and many people in the police department themselves would say we still have a ways to go. The department still has a ways to go. Our time is tight. I could talk to you forever, but our time is tight.
So I only have
one last question,
which is
how were you able to use what you learned then to push the department?
Yes, this is very
push the department forward.
Y'all need to be on your feet cheering, okay? Because this is a very, very happy story. We're in the middle of it. It is not that the whole department has changed, Michelle. It is that a specialized unit that I created with Chief Beck has completely transformed American policing. It's not the whole department. It is this one specialized unit. And let me tell you how it happened, and I don't care if we go over, y'all just going to have to wait.
We do have to...
Now.
I got to rein you in a little bit, because we do have to stay on time.
Here's the deal. A Korean-American family was getting ready to move into Jordan Downs housing project. There are 3 African-American-dominated housing projects and several Latino-dominated. I've done most of my work in Watts in these housing projects. Long story short, Korean-American family moves in. My staff come in the next day and say, Connie, I've got bad news. The Korean-American family moved in and the Grape Street Crips robbed them of every single possession they have. They didn't even let them move it off the moving truck. They just took the whole moving truck.
The Grape Street Crips,
a gang that runs Jordan Down Housing Project. Okay. Long story short, they marched the women upstairs for gang raping. Michelle, I lost it. I don't remember driving to the police headquarters, but apparently I did. I marched up the freight elevator because I refused to go through security. There's a way to get up to the top of the new LAPD building. They take the freight elevator, which is where they take the prisoners. I know this because I followed prisoners up there. And you go bypass all the security, and I marched right in. They said, Miss Rice, I'm sorry, Chief Beck is busy. I said, I don't care if he's meeting with the Pope. You get him out here now. Charlie came out. I was in tears. I don't remember crying, but apparently he'd never seen me in tears. I said, how did we let this? How do we allow this to happen? This is publicly owned housing. How do we allow this to happen to any family? This poor Korean-American family had waited 3 years to get in to this housing project, and this is what we allow to happen? Where the hell is HACLA, the housing authority? Where the hell were we?
And what grew
Where
out,
was I?
What grew out of that?
I know you're trying to hurry me along, but I want to tell this story. Here's the deal. Charlie said, Connie, you and I met in Watts 30 years ago when you were suing me, and you and I both know what these people go through. These are not people who are meant to be included. These are the people that LA discards. And we, you and I, are going to fix this. He said, what do you want? I said, I want 50 officers. He said, done. I said, I want them pay grade advance. They got to be the highest paid officers on the force. He said, done. I said, I need 10 supervisors. He said, I want 10 for 4 housing projects. He said, done. I want you to force HACLA into an MOU to have these police 24/7, no breaks and coverage. He said, done. I went down. I done. If I had known, I'd have asked for 200 officers. He was going to say that yes that easily. Bottom line, Chief Beck and I created the Community Safety Partnership Police. When Mrs. Tolliver and Mrs. Day, 2 of the gang grandmothers, heard of it, they called me up and they said, you light, white, damn near white bitch, how dare you bring these police into our housing? We do not want these cops. We hate these cops. I said, I know. You blame me. Don't blame the police. Blame me. This is my idea, and Chief Beck has to do what I tell him. I have them believe that. It's not true. They cussed me to a fare-thee-well. Well, the cops got there. Long story short, first day they got there, they said, we know you don't want us here. We have killed your children. We know you hate us. We are LAPD, and we know why you hate us. We're here to try and turn the page. Help us to keep the young kids safe. Mrs. Day and Mrs. Tolliver agreed, even though LAPD has killed 3 of their children apiece. We did training for the community so that the community could learn to think of the police differently, and we definitely retrained these cops. We told these cops, you are not in the arrest business. You will not get any credit for any arrest. You will only get credit for demonstrating how you avoided arresting a child. You will only get credit for showing that the community trusts you. You will only get credit for helping the elders. You will only get credit for helping the schools and helping kids stay in school. So, long story short, it got called Connie Rice's female policing, and it got called social working policing, and it got called a whole bunch of other derogatory things. But ladies and gentlemen, 4 years later, those cops are revered. They cleaned up Grape Street Alley. The grandmothers did a dance up and down that alley when they got done. They could have done surgery with it. It was a cesspool before they got done. LAPD called up Public Works and said, if you don't get your trucks out there, we're arresting you tomorrow. That alley was cleaned up. They then bought bifocals for the elders. They bought computers for the kids. They escort the kids to school every day. They did a farmer's market for the Ramona Gardens resident. Then they could have done surgery with it. It was a cesspool before they got done. LAPD called up Public Works and said, if you don't get your trucks out there, we're arresting you tomorrow. That alley was cleaned up. They then bought bifocals for the elders. They bought computers for the kids. They escort the kids to school every day. They did a farmer's market for the Ramona Gardens residents. And they have the lowest homicide rate in the city. Here's the deal. These cops aren't just trusted, they are revered. Mrs. Tolliver called me up. She said, yes, Miss Hyella, we still don't like you. Which is fine by me. We still don't like you, but if those cops ever leave, don't ever let them leave. So here's the thing. These are police who have been completely reoriented to earning trust through service. They are not promoted. I determine the promotions. Isn't that dangerous? Charlie Beck and I determine the promotions together. The community has to give thumbs up to this officer. The community is surveyed. Most of their evaluation is based on how the community, whether the community trusts them, whether the community thinks that cop loves their children. And ladies and gentlemen, here's the deal. Rest of the people on the panel, you want to hear this too.
One more story. Honey,
we can't do one.
Well,
more story.
When two families had all of the adults arrested, these cops adopted the black children in those families because they didn't want them to go to county care. Here's the deal. We can transform American policing. We know it because we've done it in LA. Thank you.
Thank you. Connie Rice, thank you very much. I'm going to pass the mic. Jeffrey's going to come back up, and he's going to take us home. Thank you very, very much. Connie, thank you.
Tracy's coming in. Ladies and gentlemen, I now have the great pleasure of introducing you to the leading scholar of police legitimacy in this country, Tracy Mears, who is the Walton Hale Hamilton Professor at Yale Law School. And I met in Chicago in the 90s when I was writing a piece for The New Yorker about a new theory of law enforcement that she and a few colleagues had come up with called the social norms theory. And Tracy realized that people obey the law when they trust the legitimacy of the authorities that are enforcing it. And she has gone on to be a member of the President's Task Force on Policing in the 21st Century, which President Obama formed after the Urban Spring. That commission, which Connie Rice also served on, issued its report in May. And that report embraces your central conclusions, which is that indeed legitimacy is crucial. And you begin this report by a paradox, which is that violence across the country overall is going down. People recognize that the police are responsible for violence going down, and at the same time, they don't trust the police. Trust in the police is flat. And why is that the case?
Well, Is this on? I think the reason is based in a lot of the things that you've actually heard today, right? So I'm going to be so much more boring than the other people who've gone before me. I'm sorry. But I do hope that some of the research that I'll talk about today will help to motivate us to seriously think about real policies that can change the way policing is done, to generalize some of the ideas that Connie was talking about today, and also to make maybe less difficult. I don't want to make it sound like it's easy at all, but less difficult the problem that Clifton Kinney was talking about. So here's what the research says. The research says that what people care about when they are rating folks in legal authority, so for purposes of our discussion, we're going to call that police, they care much more about how they're treated by police than how effective police are, or they care more about how they're treated than whether the decisions of police favor them or not. That doesn't mean that they don't care about those kinds of things. It would be silly to say that people don't care about how effective police are. It would be silly to say that people don't care whether or not they get a ticket or not, right? The point is that it matters to you if you get a fine or a ticket from police, from a police officer, how that police officer is treating you in the transaction, right? And so if you end up not getting a ticket when you're pulled over and the police officer treats you entirely with disrespect and does all kinds of negative things to you in the way that Clifton was talking about, then that matters to you. So here are the four things that research tell us that matters. People care about being treated with dignity and respect. They care about being able to assess whether the decisions of a legal authority is fair, grounded in fact, is transparent. So if you think about a police stop, it matters to a person that they're told why they were stopped by the police, for example. People care about having input into a decision by a legal authority. So if you're thinking about the kind of strategies that Connie was just talking about, it matters to people that they have a role to play in developing those strategies. And in a particular interaction, let's say when you're pulled over by a cop, it matters to you to be able to tell your side of the story. And research tells us that this matters even when it doesn't make a difference to the outcome. And then last, people are looking for ways to assess whether a person in legal authority over them can be trusted to treat them benevolently in the future. So one way of thinking about that is to think, if you're a person who has never had an interaction with a police officer, but the people that you know, people in your family, people in your neighborhood, your friends, have had negative interactions, then it's unlikely that you are going to expect that person to treat you benevolently in the future. Those four factors together are called procedural justice. And the research also shows that when legal authorities act in ways that are consistent with procedural justice, people are willing to confer legitimacy, trust, and the like in police and other legal authority. That's the research in a nutshell.
And give us specific examples of cities or police departments that have implemented these principles successfully.
Well, so one way of thinking about it is that there are different ways to do it. So I could describe what Connie was talking about in the housing authority in LA as a way of doing this, right? And one way they did that is by changing the incentive structure. They didn't say that crime reduction was self-justifying. What they said was, we are going to evaluate you based on whether you do things that increase trust, whether you make fewer rather than more arrests, whether people in the community are willing to work with you. All of those things are consistent with this theory. I've seen examples of it in Newark. I've seen examples of it in Chicago, where Gary McCarthy has spent a lot of time training every police officer in the city of Chicago consistent with these ideas. So there are different manifestations of it. In fact, the ceasefire idea that you were talking about, depending on how it's done, can be done in that way, right? I think the key to it is understanding that there can be costs to aggressive policing for the sake of crime reduction without thinking about the potential impact that can have on public trust.
Tell us about the three elements that ceasefire-like interactions between communities and the police have, because it's a very interesting way of generalizing these lessons.
Oh, you mean the structure of the meeting?
Structure. How do you have
like
the meetings?
The three elements. It's like, this is a quiz. No. I give the exams here.
you taught me this stuff. I can't believe I remember it 20 years later. But
okay.
You came up with this great idea of bringing offenders and the police together.
Right.
And you told me that there have to be three elements to these meetings.
So I didn't. The thing that the program that I actually developed in Chicago was based on David Kennedy's work in Boston. So that was Boston Ceasefire. And what those meetings have three parts. First, law enforcement community tells, well, let's back up. The people in the room are potential offenders, basically. And sometimes they're family members, sometimes not. And members of law enforcement, members of a sort of service provider community, and importantly, someone who used to be involved in criminal offending and has changed their life around, right? So the first part of the meeting is explaining to folks in a very dispassionate way, these are the consequences of future offending, the legal consequences. The second part is having a person say, I changed my life, you can change it too. You can change yours too. And the third part is service provision about we're here to help. Now, it's interesting. The mayors who were speaking before, I think it was Mayor Walsh, I don't know if he's still in here, he said, well, ceasefire is much more about violence reduction. It's not so much about, you know, addressing these issues of race. It's not directly about issues of procedural justice and legitimacy, and I agree. The point is when you are engaged in that process, if you're trying to address violence reduction in that way, as opposed to, let's say, what New York did, going out and stopping and frisking hundreds and thousands of people for the sake of getting guns that they never got, right? It's a strategy that is obviously more likely to be perceived as legitimate by the community than that approach. So I think that's the way I would put it.
You note that violence is going down. Is police violence going down, or is it up or stable?
That's an interesting question. I think the best estimate, so first, we don't actually count and assess police shootings. That was one in a systematic way. That was one of the recommendations of the president's task force. That said, there has been data gathered on police shootings, police fatalities in particular in major cities over time. And if you look at that data, which does have some problems associated with it, if you look at that data, I think it's fair to say that the number of police fatalities has gone down. However, it is also true that we are at extremely high levels compared to any other, you know, country, and these shootings are so much more salient than they were before because of social media. So we're paying attention to it in a way that we never have. It's not the invisible number. It's not the mystery number. It's not the problem that no one knows about anymore.
The President's Commission made recommendations about the use of social media, and it was really interesting to hear the mayor say they're releasing videos right away. How can social media be used to increase trust rather than decrease it?
Wow. I mean, I have to admit that is not a question that I have thought seriously about. Here's what I can say, that as we are paying attention to these incidents, and as they become more salient, I would say that one way social media can help us to build trust and maintain trust is to ensure that we don't let go of this moment, right? This is a moment in time. It's a critical, pivotal moment in history, I think. Yesterday, someone was talking about the potential for another Reconstruction, right? And if we see this as, you know, the third Reconstruction, you were talking about, you know, the spring, then that in that way, I think social media, following what youth are doing, following their lead, paying attention to the protests, paying attention to the arguments that people are making, and understanding it in the context of what people care about, right? Which is not that safety is just a matter of crime reduction, right? Safety is a matter of your security. I'm going to use that term. Security is a matter of the relationship of the public to the state.
This is the 150th anniversary of the 13th Amendment, which Clifton Kenny mentioned, and he also, next year is the 150th anniversary of the 14th Amendment after the Civil War. Clifton mentioned how those amendments were subverted after the Civil War by things like the Black Codes, which denied African Americans the right to make contracts and to be full citizens. What in the president's task force are the central recommendations that could be the basis for a third Reconstruction?
Okay. So
just light questions here in Aspen.
Let me start small and try to build, okay?
Okay.
Where I want to start is this idea that crime reduction is not self-justifying, okay? In order for us to have a change of mindset, a change of culture, right, policing agencies need to understand that while they contribute to public safety, that any aggressive strategy that they undertake is not a warrant for itself. And that's in part what this procedural justice idea is about. And so when you understand that at its essence, legitimacy is about a citizen looking at a legal authority and saying, I want you to treat me as someone who counts in your eyes. And everything you do has to demonstrate that to me. Right? Then you understand that what this is really about is understanding the terms of citizenship in a very real way. And we haven't actually ever really done it. Right? We haven't really done it. That's Clifton's point, I think. So that's the terms, I think, right, of the third Reconstruction. If I can have like 10 seconds.
Yes, ma'am.
Right? If you look at the 14th Amendment, the 13th Amendment, the Constitution, right, that is a formal curriculum of citizenship. It tells us who we are and how we value freedoms of all individuals. But the reality is, if we're talking about policing, how police treat people in public, especially in the neighborhoods that Clifton was talking about, is a hidden curriculum. It's a hidden curriculum that is inconsistent with that formal curriculum, and everything that he's describing that police do is actually inconsistent with that formal curriculum. And so when those two clash, right, you have a sense of who the citizen is. The citizen is the one who's treated consistent with the formal curriculum, and the anti-citizen is the one who is not treated in that way. And until we have a system in which the formal curriculum and the hidden curriculum are the same for everybody, because I guarantee you the hidden curriculum is right for all of you sitting here, right? How police treat you is the way the formal curriculum says they should treat you. Then we will have achieved the goal of the third Reconstruction.
Beautiful.
You like that?
Nice. Very nice. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been an extraordinarily meaty and substantive session. It is an experiment, which is why the timing is a little flexible. So although we don't have time for Q&A, we are going to conclude with Joe Nocera, the great New York Times columnist, talking to us about guns and violence. Please welcome Joe Nocera.
Well, I've only got a few minutes, and I'll try to keep it in that time frame. I don't have much scholarship on policing, so I'm going to stay away from that aspect. I have a fair amount of scholarship on guns. And the reason I have a reason for that is that one of the things I did after Newtown was I started something called the Gun Report. And it was a daily compilation of gun violence that we just plucked from Google News and other news sources. And we just listed it. No editorial commentary. And among the things I learned was that there's an astounding amount of accidental shootings involving children, which are extraordinarily preventable. But the second thing that I learned was that the majority of the violence that we published every day was, as Mr. Davis said, neighbor-on-neighbor crime, mostly in minority neighborhoods. What do you do about that? Can you do anything about that in this current era that we live in, where, thanks to the Supreme Court in 2008, owning a gun is now viewed as an individual right, even in major cities, where that poses all sorts of threats to the community? Well, one way to think about this, is two central points I want to make. The first is Mayor Landrieu described shootings, gun violence that takes place in his city as an epidemic. And an epidemic is a really good way to think about gun violence. In fact, in the mid-90s, a scientist named Gary Slotkin came back from Africa, where he'd been spending 10 years dealing with epidemics, trying to figure out how to keep AIDS from spreading. And the violence he saw in Chicago made him think that this really replicated an epidemic. It took place in clusters. The way you could predict violence in a community was based on whether there'd been violence before. And he started a program. So how do you deal with an epidemic? You intervene. That's what you do. You intervene. That's what we did with Ebola. That's what people did with Ebola. You intervene. You isolate it. You know. And so he began a program, and I saw a replica of it in New York a couple of years ago. A program called Save Our Streets, where they have interveners, actual interveners, people who have been in prison or who have been the victims of gun violence, who understand gun violence, who would go out on the streets, meet the people who are most likely to commit gun violence, get to know them, even go to the hospital when there were some times when there was a gun violent incident to try and prevent a reciprocal violent episode. It has worked remarkably well. And when you say, well, why would gang members listen to interveners? Why would this make any difference? Well, what is the gang member's biggest fear? It's being shot. People don't really want to be shot. But because they feel like there's no other choice, because they feel like this is the world in which they live, in which guns are so prevalent, this is the epidemic that we have given to ourselves. When you talk to the extremists, and I really do mean the extremists on the Second Amendment side, the gun right absolutists, there's no question that they view, there's a horrible thing to say, but they view the sort of massacres that took place at Charleston and Aurora and Newtown, and also the black-on-black violence, the neighbor-on-neighbor violence that takes place in so many of our cities, they view this as just the price you have to pay for the Second Amendment, and it's just too bad. I don't believe that's true, and I don't believe that I don't believe that as a country we can't do something about reducing violence in the cities and reducing the number of guns and the availability of guns, even with the 2008 Supreme Court decision. There's a gun expert named Daniel Webster who gave a TED talk not long ago, and he basically pointed out that one of the things you could do is just make it harder for illegal guns to get to cities. So how would you do this? Well, one way you could do this is to basically regulate gun dealers better. You don't even have to regulate. Just have a transparent system where the gun dealers whose guns most often show up in a crime get posted on a website. There have been experiments along this line where it actually made a big difference until Congress changed the law, so now they can't do that anymore. But one way to, most of the guns in these communities are not legal guns. It's possible to trace them. There are technologies coming along, micro stamping, and so on, which would allow police, investigators, and others to trace a bullet to the gun where that gun was sold. So you could actually trace the chain, and you could figure out who sold the gun? Who gave the gun? How did the gun get to be to the person who committed the crime? These are completely dual propositions. All they require from our society is the will to do them. I will stop here. We've kind of run out of time. Thank you very much. This was an extraordinary hour and a half.
Sorry we skipped the Q&A, but the panelists will be around to take your questions in the lobby area. Thank you.